The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, cause we're Skeptically Speaking.
Hello and welcome to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Shell. This week, we look at zombies and how my favorite movie monsters find parallels in real-world science. We'll talk to entomologist David Hughes about parasites that make controlling the brains of their hosts part of their reproductive routine. But first, mathematician Robert Smith joins us to explain how math could help us overcome a zombie invasion. Thanks for listening. I'm here with Robert Smith, professor in the Department of Mathematics at the University of Ottawa. He uses mathematical modeling to study diseases like the flu, malaria, and HIV. He's done postdoctoral study in infectious diseases at the University of Western Ontario and the University of California in Los Angeles. He's the author of a textbook called Modeling Disease Ecology with Mathematics and is co-editor of a book of essays about Doctor Who called Time Unincorporated. Welcome to Skeptically Speaking, Robert.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
So in 2009, you did something that I consider to be one of the most important contributions to disease literature. You examined a zombie outbreak. So thank you, first of all.
Well, you know, when you're surrounded and in fear of your life and the zombies are at the door, what else do? You call the mathematicians.
I like that, actually. You know, I personally have been prepared for a zombie attack since I was about 14 years old. And when this study came out, I immediately printed it out and put a copy in my zombie-killing chest.
Yeah.
Right next to the sword, and I'm not even joking.
That's awesome.
So let's go to the beginning. This came out of a class on disease modeling.
Yes, exactly. And it was a class where I just assigned the students a project, and I said, you can do any project you like involving disease. And, you know, there were a bunch of different diseases. There was malaria, and there was HIV, and then there was one on zombies. And I think the students thought that I would never go for it, but I don't think they realized what a nerd I was. And I was so excited, and I thought, this is going to be really, really fun. But I think I thought, this will amuse me and no one else. And the students will like it, I'll like it. That's the end of the story. A lot of people got very excited.
Very, very excited. You received a lot of media attention around this.
Yes, I think it sort of hit at the right time. It was, you know, it was summer, it was a slow news month, there was no elections, no natural disasters and so on. So we sort of hit the right niche at the right time. But I think also it really fired the imagination. And what was really, really nice actually was it drew a lot of attention to what I do, which is mathematical modeling of disease. And a lot of people emailed me and said, I never knew there was such a thing. This is so exciting. I see the possibilities here. And it opened people's minds, I think, to you know, wider applications of mathematics.
Initially, you were looking at epidemics that there weren't already models for.
Yes, exactly. And I'm very interested in creating models from the ground up. And I think a lot of people are a little afraid to do that because it requires knowing a lot of the biology. And usually people either know biology and know math, or they know math and not in biology. But I've been linking the two, and my students have been linking the two. And I think there's a sort of generational change coming through where people are having a grounding in both sciences. And so I like this idea of taking a disease you don't know, figuring everything out from scratch, building a mathematical model, and then finding what the conclusions are. And then maybe you change the model a bit because you have some more information and you go around the circle a few times, but eventually you come to something that's quite interesting. And the zombies were in part a way to understand that and also understand how the process works, because we created, I think, about 5 models in there, and that we had our basic model, then we refined it to include latency, then we refined it again, we included interventions, different scenarios, and it was a really nice teaching tool, I think, to learn how to model something you don't know.
How can you compare hypothetical zombie outbreaks to real examples of disease?
The major difference with zombies compared to other things is that, of course, the dead come back to life. And so that's obviously not a factor in other diseases. Another factor, too, which is that we try and kill the people who are infected. And obviously, we don't want to be doing that in real diseases either. It's you know, a little unethical. And so, you know, we're not taking to the streets when somebody has influenza. And I think that's good. So what you get is you get some very, very different scenarios going on. But on the other hand, we learn some lessons. And I've later actually applied some of the same mathematics to different diseases in a way that actually people were too afraid to do. They said, oh, we can't have these two complicated terms going on. We can deal with one or the other, but not both. And I said, you know what, I had to deal with this with the zombies. Let me apply this here. And it worked out because I knew what I was doing. And people got very excited. They said, oh, we learned lessons from zombies. This is so great. And so we're applying that to human papillomavirus, so, you know, real problems dealing with real things. And so I think that the issue for mathematical modeling is that you're not trying to take the same model and apply it to something else. you know, if you try and take a model for malaria and apply it to zombies, it's not going to work. And I think that's even true if you're trying to take a model for malaria and apply it to dengue, which is very, very similar to malaria. I think you still want to go back to the disease and go back to the biology. And there's a lot of reluctance to do that, because once you put a lot of time into your model, you want to use that model. And I think what the zombies help us to see is, you know, it's okay to go back to the biology, start from scratch, and deal with that.
Well, let's talk about the model. Now, in your examination, you focused on one particular kind of movie zombie, right?
Yes, we were looking at the Romero zombie in particular, and my students were real zombie fans, and so they were zombie purists, and they said, oh, that 28 Days Later zombie is not a real zombie, they're not actually undead, it's just a rage virus, and so on. And so I was sort of a bit more free-flowing. I said, well, you know, it's good to limit ourselves a bit, because I think, you know, you can try and be all things to all people, but at some point you want to narrow it down and say, okay, what exactly specifically are we thinking about? So that gave us a sort of something to hang our hat on, that we can say, okay, we're dealing with the slow-moving zombie. And I think what came out of that actually was, the slow-moving zombie turns out to be a very effective zombie. And I think before, people just kind of assumed that the fast-moving zombie is the scary one. And that's true if you're in its way. If you're standing in front of a fast-moving zombie, that's bad for you. But for society as a whole, I think the fast-moving zombie, like fast-moving diseases, tends to burn itself out. And so we see that with Ebola and stuff, that the, you know, Ebola comes to your village and everybody's dead before they can get to the next village. So Ebola is not actually a massive worldwide pandemic. Whereas a much slower disease like HIV, that's an enormously successful disease, because it's got a very long latency period. It's kind of stealth in the way it comes in. You don't have symptoms for a long time and so on. And so it reinforced some of the things about disease as well. So it was kind of a feedback loop. And I think a slow-moving disease or slow-moving zombies can actually do a lot more damage. And I think, too, at the beginning, if there are slow-moving zombies, we might not notice for a while. And so the zombies can really have a good chance to get a foot in society before we actually do anything about them.
So if you would have chosen to go with runners instead of shamblers, would you have had to change the model significantly?
I think in a few key areas, yes. There's different ways to model, and you could look at sort of the parameter choices, so sort of how fast something occurs. That might be just changing a number. And so we considered this in some generality before we put specific numbers in to try and get general results. So we could say, okay, we have general results. We could apply specific numbers for fast zombies. But then there's also some things about sort of the way you interact. For example, the fast zombies might be much better at killing us than we are at killing them. And so the slow-moving zombie bites us, or it might kill us, but not very efficiently. So you can sort of say, well, its level of death efficiency is pretty low, but a fast-moving zombie, you might have to really take that into account. And so I think, yes, you would tweak the model, but you'd probably use the basic structure.
Well, now you use something called the impulsive differential equations to make your model. Can you just give us a brief explanation of what they are?
You know, most mathematics that vast majority of people ever see in their life vastly predates the 20th century. The sort of latest thing you probably see is complex numbers, which were sort of wondered about in the 15th century and sort of only really came to prominence in about 1920 or so. So mathematics is very, very old. And impulsive differential equations were invented in the 90s. Right, so this is up-to-date cutting-edge mathematics, which is something we never run into. Usually the cutting-edge mathematics is so up in the clouds that very few people can get hold of it, even mathematicians. And impulsive differential equations is something that I did my PhD in, so I knew a lot about, and I was, you know, teaching that to my students, and they were very excited about it. So they liked them, and they wanted to use them somehow, so we sort of figured out how it could work in the zombie model. And I think what it did was it gained a lot of publicity for those as well, and a lot of mathematicians said, oh, I didn't know about these kinds of equations as well. And what they are is they're a way to just understand if you have a shock to the system. So you might have a shock, for example, if you're taking drugs. Your body is metabolizing a drug, and then you take a pill, and that's a big, big shock. You suddenly have a lot of drug happening very, very quickly. And so the time between taking a pill is quite long compared to the time which your body has to metabolize the instant pill that you get. And so what you can do is you can approximate that the pill's taking time. It's about 20 minutes for your body to absorb maximum amount of drug. You can approximate that by instant change and say, instead of that 20 minutes, I'm just going to ignore that and assume that happens instantaneously. And then I really care about the rest of the time. I really care about how long it takes for the drug to dissipate in my body and for my body to clean it up. And so that's where the impulsive differential equations come in the mathematical sense. And so then you can use it for other things that have shocks. You can use it for vaccines. You could use it for spraying insecticides. And in our case, we used it for killing zombies in large numbers.
This is an intense study, an intense fictional study, sir.
It really got to the heart of a lot of neat stuff, because you're taking biology, you're trying to understand the mechanism of the biology, you make a mathematical model from that, and then from the math, you're trying to sort of use this, you know, very detailed analysis. And the great thing about mathematics, I think, is it's like a language, right? And it's a very sophisticated language, and it's a language that has access to logic and rigor, so that when you speak in that language, you speak in a very, very coded way that leads you from one step to the next. Whereas, of course, most languages are very woolly and you sort of go in circles and so on. Math gives you a roadmap. And so that's the real use of mathematics, because you build your model, and your model is really just a translation from the real world. And so once you have your model, you follow the mathematics, and it leads you inexorably to a conclusion, and then you bring that back to the biology, and you have an answer to your biological question that you couldn't have answered in the real world, because the real world is not clear-cut. But mathematics is very clear-cut.
Now, you ran the model with different time periods for infection to set in after an encounter. And in the first version, you had infection taking place right away, and the results were, let's say, less than optimistic.
Yes, we had about 4 days, I think 4.5 days, before humanity was overrun. We modeled a city about the size of Ottawa, which is about 500,000 people or so, and we had one zombie to start with. So one zombie faces, 500,000 humans, and in 4.5 days, everybody's a zombie. Now, perhaps in Ottawa, no one would really notice, but nevertheless, that was the result. That was less than less than heartening, I should say, but not wholly unexpected, because we do see zombies, in the movies. They take over very, very quickly. Mm-hmm. And so I guess it was actually encouraging to see that's what happens here as well. And I think part of it is that there's no escape from our model, right? Because you could be born and you become a human, then you become a zombie, and then you could die. And if you're a human, you could die. If you're a zombie, you could die. But then the dead come back to life. And so there's no way out of the system, right? And so what do the zombies do? They harvest the living humans and they harvest the dead, and nobody's leaving. And so there's just endless fodder for the zombies. So this is really why the zombies take over, in a sense.
Well, in the second version, though, you extended the time of infection to about 24 hours. So how did that change the results?
It didn't change anything qualitatively. What it did, though, was it gave it a little delay. And so that makes a lot of sense, actually. And I think a good thing to ask yourself is, does this result make sense? Just in a sort of broad, heuristic way, is this reasonable? And because sometimes the answer is not reasonable. And if you said, oh, this changes things massively, then you might want to go back and say, is my model really working? But it should sort of make sense. And, you would expect that there's a delay in the biting. So therefore, there's a delay in how long until humanity is wiped out. And I think we had then about 7 days. So you buy yourself a little bit of time. 24 hours delay in the zombies means 3 more days of humanity survival. It's not great, but it's a little bit.
3 whole days.
Yes. And, well, that's 3 more days, I guess, to come up with a cure or to come up with a counter plan or so on. In those 3 days or in that 7 days that's happening, we're still fighting the zombies. So we still had people attacking zombies, people fighting back and so on. So we built that into our model, and that was probably giving us more time than we would have had otherwise.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and I'm here with Robert Smith, the lovely gentleman who developed a mathematical model of a zombie outbreak. We'll be right back with more of that after this.
Skeptically Speaking wants you to question everything. To be a part of the discussion, call and record your question on our listener question line at Speak 73101. That's 773-257-3101. Long distance charges may apply. Sunday nights at 6 Mountain Time, join our Ustream chat room to listen and ask questions as we record interviews live. Just click the Listen Online button at skepticallyspeaking.com. You can also email your questions and comments to live@skepticallyspeaking.com, or if you're on Twitter, tweet us at Skeptical Radio. And now back to the show.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm here with mathematician Robert Smith, who authored a textbook called Modeling Disease Ecology with Mathematics. And we're talking about zombies. Now, you also introduced some strategies for managing a zombie outbreak to see how that would affect the outcome. What were those?
It's very important for us to fight back. So we are naturally killing zombies, because that's what we would do, right? So we didn't build that in as a specific strategy. We built that in as a very fundamental thing, that we're, of course, fighting back, and we're doing the best we can. But then we wanted to look at some bigger things. And initially, I assumed there's one obvious thing, which is quarantine. And that's, I think, the easiest, sort of first response you would do to a new disease. You try and put people who are infected into quarantine. And what quarantine really means is they are no longer able to infect people. And so you can take zombies out of the picture, and we imagine we put them in some big pen and we sort of posted snipers around the edge. And so the zombies were just sort of in there mixing around with each other, but they were not able to infect any humans. And what we showed was that this was actually not very useful in the long run. And this surprised me, actually, because I sort of talked to the students and we agreed on doing quarantine. I thought that would be the end of the story. And quite surprisingly, it really didn't buy us very much time. I think it bought us an extra day. And there are issues with quarantine, though, because if you want to capture a zombie, then an actual honest-to-goodness zombie, you know what it looks like. Unfortunately, it may also try and kill you. So you can find it, but you can't capture it so easily. Conversely, people who've been infected but who are not yet zombies, you may have very, very easy time capturing them because they're not going to fight back, but you don't know what they look like. And as we often see in the movies, people don't reveal their status. And so they're not willingly going to go into the zombie quarantine pen. That means you're going to have a hard time finding these people. And what we showed was actually those people were the real drivers of the quarantine. Right? You had to capture a significant number of them in order for the quarantine to work. And the chances are that you're not going to get large numbers of them.
Could you also build the concept of human error into that quarantine section of the model?
Yes, you can actually look at all the parameters and do a sort of sensitivity analysis. And so I think that's very important. We didn't actually run that for the zombie model, but it can certainly be built on. And I've done some follow-up stuff where we looked at that. And I think it's good to build in some sort of noise and say, okay, we might have measured the parameter, but then, of course, there are all sorts of factors going on in real life, and these parameters are going to vary. And I think with something like zombies, of course, we didn't measure the parameters. You know, we know how long a human lives, but we don't know how long a zombie lives necessarily, or you know, how long it's going to take before someone becomes one. And so you might want to build in the variation, and that variation takes into account uncertainty in the measurement, it takes into account human error, it takes into account any other sort of inbuilt errors that might go in. And I've done a lot of work since then actually looking at sort of variations in those things and whether they matter or not.
So you also looked at treatment.
Yes. So we assumed that we are excellent scientists and we could come up with a cure in the, you know, 7.5 days before humanity was wiped out. And so brilliant as we are, we invent a cure that can turn a zombie back into a human. So we said, well, you know, maybe we're not that brilliant. If we can turn a zombie back into a human, it probably cannot be immune for life. So we say that we turn a zombie into a human, but then if another zombie bites that human, well, it's a zombie again. All right, so we sort of said, okay, this is pretty good. And what we get then is you get this sort of pitched battle between the cure and the zombies. And you have the zombies biting humans, and they're recruiting more to their numbers. And of course, they're being latently infected first, and then they become zombies after 24 hours. The zombies are killing some of us, and then they're raising their dead back to life. So they're getting their numbers there. But we're fighting back too, because we're A, killing the zombies, as we always are, and then B, curing some of the zombies and turning them back into humans who can then fight for us. And so you get this sort of back and forth, and eventually what happens is it settles down to some steady state. So the system is in some equilibrium, and that equilibrium doesn't mean nothing's happening, but it means it's in stasis. So for every zombie that is recruited from one of us, we're also able to cure one. And so there might be a lot of back and forth going on, but it's sitting and the numbers are stable. And what we showed was that this was great in the sense that humans were not all dead, right? There are humans alive. We can guarantee humans and zombies coexisting. This is encouraging. And so I think this is where the theory versus practice comes into play, because in the mathematics, we said, great, we have an outcome that is not the death of all humans. Let's celebrate and go home. When we put the numbers in, though, what we found was that it was less than 10% survival for the humans. So, you know, your city of 500,000 people has about 40,000 people still alive. This is, you know, small numbers compared to sort of the numbers you'd like to survive. And I think there were about sort of 60,000 or more zombies wandering around. This is a lot of zombies per human. So they do coexist, but it's not really the kind of coexistence we want. It's not sort of one zombie for one human. It's a lot of zombies. So really what we're probably thinking is a lot of people in farmhouses and shopping malls hold up, fighting off zombies, every so often curing one, dragging one inside, and then the zombies dragging one of us outside. And we're sort of going back and forth like this.
I'm wondering about that. Now, why couldn't we reach sort of a predator-prey equilibrium like we see in nature?
Yeah, I think we sort of would, actually. It's just one where the predator is doing much, much better. In nature, of course, the predator will die if there's no prey. Right? And so if you have sort of, you know, foxes and rabbits, if there are no rabbits, the foxes will starve. And even if the rabbit numbers are low, the foxes will starve. And in a sense, that's sort of true for zombies, except that the zombies also have access to the dead. And so you've got this vast pool of the dead sitting there that the zombies can just reanimate. So even if our numbers go down, well, probably a lot of us are dead, and so the zombies just bring them back up. So the zombies do very, very well.
I do have to point out that you referred to the fighting back part as impulsive eradication.
Yes. We assumed that people were sort of fighting in a very individualistic way, on a sort of everyday basis, as you probably would be. If there's zombies at your house, then you're going to go outside and try and shoot it or something like that. But then we also said, okay, probably at some point civilization itself fights back. And I think most of the zombie movies, of course, are very, very concerned with civilization. Metaphorically, they're fundamentally about looking at civilization and wondering if it's worth saving, and often realizing actually what was so great about civilization in the first place. And so what they sometimes do, and you see something like Shaun of the Dead, they send in the army at the end. And suddenly the army comes in, and they've got massive firepower, and you know they can really hit the zombies pretty hard. And so this was perfect for our impulsive differential equations. We said, okay, let's bring in a big force that can do something very, very effective, but it's not going to do it on a day-to-day basis. It's the troops mobilized, they come in, they blow the zombies to kingdom come, And then they sort of reconvene, and then they don't do anything for another 2 days, and then they all get together and they blow them away again. And we built in a further thing, which, as we said, probably they learn a bit from their experiences. On day one, they're not very good at killing the zombies, but on day two, they're a bit better. On day three, they're even better. And so if they improve, then what you actually see is only under this scenario do you get eradication of the zombies.
Interesting. We have a couple of audience questions here. This one's from Sarah C. Did you take into account that in order to actually turn a human into a zombie, the human has to escape long enough for the infection to kill and reanimate them and not simply be eaten by the currently existing zombie horde?
It's very interesting when you try and think about how infection works. The way to create a system of mathematical equations for a disease or zombies or whatever is you have to understand what goes in and what goes out. And so if you think about a zombie, you say, well, how do you become a zombie and how do you stop being a zombie? And the way to become a zombie is you either infect somebody or you raise the dead, or you can leave being a zombie by being killed, and that's about it. And so if you add more things, then you could be quarantined or something like that. But in the basic model, you either make a zombie from the dead or the living, and you leave a zombie by being killed. And then you have to do that for every class. You have to say, well, how do humans become humans? Well, they're born. How do they stop being humans? They either die. They could die of natural causes. They could die of being killed by a zombie. Or they can also be infected by a zombie, and then they go through that path to inexorably becoming a zombie. And so what you have actually is an argument of probabilities. You know, at any given time, what's the probability of things that could happen to me? And the probability that I die of old age is very, very tiny. The probability that I'm bitten by the zombie at my door is very, very high. And so usually that wins, but not always, of course. And so the zombie might infect me, or it might kill me, or I might drop dead of old age. And there's a small, small chance that could happen. And what the equations are really doing, actually, is not modeling individuals. They're modeling a wavefront. And so they sort of have this wavefront approximation to humans and zombies and so on. And so it's not five individuals, you know, five zombies and three humans. It's sort of a continuous sort of distribution between them. So in overall, the population would be driven by percentages. You say, okay, you'd have sort of, you know, X percentage humans, X percentage zombies. So it approximates individuals. What this means is it's really useful for big populations. It's not as useful for very, very small numbers. So as you get down to eradication, you might have to change your scale a bit. So the answer is yes, we did take that into account, and it's built into the model through the use of the probabilities here, which feed into the differential equations, which are balanced by understanding what comes in and what goes out. So it's actually a very, very neat thing once you put all the pieces together, and I think not impenetrable. Like, you have to know a bit of mathematics in order to analyze it, but you don't have to know terribly much to understand just how the model works in the first place.
Right.
And I think that was what was a great thing about this article going viral, as it were, because people got enough just to say, you know what, I didn't really follow all the mathematical details, but I can look at your model and see some stuff, and I sort of see what goes where, and I sort of see how I could build that. And that's exactly what I do all the time, is I often work with people in government, people in, you know, Health Canada and so on, and I don't need them to understand how to solve an equation. I need them to look at my mathematical model and say, is this good enough?
Exactly.
Is there anything missing? Have you included this? What about that? Oh, I see you've put that term in. What do we think about that? And if they can get to that point, we're good to go, because I can take it all the rest of the way, but I need their input into understanding where the biology comes in.
We have a question from Jackie in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Zombie outbreaks involving the fast variety typically portray the zombies as having boundless energy. In the real world, where they wouldn't be able to run for 12 hours straight, would an outbreak be as severe as you might think? And I take it that actually follows for shamblers as well.
The zombie energy question is a really interesting one, and I think a bit like the sort of origin of zombies, we don't really try and address that one very often. The movies, I think they're much more interested in the metaphor of the zombie than the actual physics of the zombie. The movies like to sort of say, okay, we're in a zombie outbreak, it's happening now. We maybe wonder about where it came from, but we don't really investigate that too often. And we don't really think too much about where the energy comes from or where it goes. And if you sort of think about, okay, they reanimate the dead, what does that look like? Probably most of the dead are not really very functional because they died. Even if somehow you imbued them with some sort of living essence, they're probably not going to do very well. They'd have to have some sort of consciousness to kind of get around just objects in the street and not run into trees and stuff like that. But they've, you know, seem to have very minimal intelligence and so on. So I think, could the zombie in reality, you know, exist? Probably not, because the energy question actually does then become important. But in the fictional zombieverse, yeah, the zombies do seem to do very well, right? They don't need us to survive. They just like to kill us. They like to eat our brains, but they don't seem to need it for sustenance. They don't need it for energy. I think they just want to take us out, rather, because we're their only predator.
So is there anything else now that, looking back, you would have included in your model?
there's a rich, rich vein of zombieism to go in. What I've done is I've done a couple of edited collections that are coming out shortly. One's mathematical modeling of zombies, where we've looked at lots of different things. And it's not just me, but a whole bunch of contributors have come in. And some have sort of said, oh, let's put this in, let's put that in. And what we've also done is looking at zombies in society. So sort of zombies in other academic fields and so on. And sort of, you know, there's like disability theory, there's feminism, there's law, there's archaeology, you name it. Everybody wanted to do zombies. And so I think that there was an enormous number of things we could have done. What I was really happy with about the model was showing how it is that you could add things in. So anyone can add more stuff. And it sort of says, once you've made your base model, you can just tweak and tweak and tweak, and whatever factor you decide is important, you can easily put in. My number one probably would be spatial variation. If you think about the environment which zombies live, objects become very important. Where are the zombies? Where are the humans? That matters a lot. But also what's in their way? You know, if you sort of think, okay, if it's open fields and there's zombies and us, probably we don't have much of a chance. But actually, most of the zombie outbreaks we sort of see happen in urban centers.
Right.
And urban centers are a great zombie defense because they've got roads, they've got curbs, they've got park benches, trees, you know, abandoned cars, all sorts of things which are going to present a problem for the zombies. The zombies are probably going to trip over them. They're not going to do very well on inclines. They're going to run into all the things that are not issues for us. And also there's buildings, and so we can weave in and out of buildings. All of those things, I think, would make a big, big impression on what the outcome is. And so we might actually do a lot better, given the spatial considerations, than the zombies do.
You are totally blowing my mind, honestly. So all that said, how prepared should we as individuals be in terms of weapons and escape plans and such? Because, as I said, I have a sword. I'm sure I'm fine. But for others, should they escape from, let's say, the city, or should they hole up?
When faced with a zombie outbreak, which is, you know, it's one of those great questions of civilization. And I think what's wonderful about the zombies is that, you know, they allow us to explore very, very primal fears. Fear of a disease, which you can't control. It's coming at you, you know, you're going to live or die on random chance. I think zombies sort of have that power to them. They have fear of a predator, which, you know, we don't really have natural predators, but the zombies allow us to think about that. And fear of the apocalypse, which, you know, is something that seems, you know, very real to a lot of people and very scary and sort of, you know, might be around the corner for all we know. And it's, I think the zombies are a way of, you know, living that fear and seeing what that might do. Then the question is, well, what do you do? In the face of a deadly apocalypse, what's the solution? And the two answers that come up are fight or flight, right? Is it, you know, pick up a gun and start shooting, or is it run away and hide? Neither is actually very effective in the long run, because if you think about it, you know, if you try and shoot something that's moving, it's not very easy actually at all, right? You have to be a pretty good shot. And, you know, I've tried that once or twice. It's really hard to shoot a moving object. And then you've got to shoot the moving object in the head. Right? You can probably do that a bit if there's 15,000 of them coming at you. Then you're going to run out of bullets really, really quickly. And even if you hole yourself up in a munitions factory and so on, there's 15,000 zombies, you're going to run out of bullets really, really quickly.
Sword, right here.
Yeah, sword is pretty good in close range, I think. But even so, I think you're going to need a longer-term strategy.
Right.
And the weapon is a sort of very short-term, individualistic, sort of neoliberal panic that says, well, I want to survive. And of course I want to survive, right? I'm an individual, I'd like to live. But it doesn't really take into account all the other things that might help me, which is other people and their skills, because other people have skills I don't have at all. And so when I run out of bullets, can I operate complex bullet-making machinery? Can I mine the ground for more materials? No, I don't know how to do any of those things. I live in an interdependent society where I need other people to do those things for me. I have my skills, they have their skills. They can't do my skills either. So, you know, we need each other. And I think what's so interesting in the zombie movies is that they take this away from us, right? And they almost always lead us to the end of civilization where it's each person for themselves. Whereas, in fact, this is actually the zombies' plan all along, I think. The best thing the zombies can do for themselves is to wipe out civilization, because civilization is the zombies' greatest threat. We can do things the zombies can't. We are smart. They are not. We can build moats. We can electrify fences. We can, you know, create more bullets. We can, you know, we can keep society running. Society would be a great defense against zombies. And of course, society is always the first thing that zombies take out. Coincidence? I think not. Ironically, I think the thing the zombies are actually most scared of is brains, right? It's our brains that are our best weapon.
We have a question from Kylie Sturgis. Out of all of the fictional portrayals, film or graphic/novel, which one, in your opinion, is the closest to actually being able to happen? And what ingredient is the most common mistake that they make?
I think I would have to say Shaun of the Dead, partly because Shaun of the Dead is in some ways, the epitome of the classic zombie movie. I mean, it's got all the tropes in it. And when we were doing the zombie paper, actually, we watched a lot of zombie movies, and you know, my students were very familiar to begin with. They played a lot of video games and so on. But after we'd done all that, we kept going back to Shaun of the Dead as our shorthand. We'd, you know, model something, and they'd come in and say, oh, look, Ian, we've done this. And I'd say, no, in Shaun of the Dead, this happens. And they, oh, yeah, you're right. You know, go back and fix the equations. And that just became the shorthand, because every single thing you can meaningful about zombies is in there somewhere.
Right.
And I think, you know, Shaun of the Dead has that beautiful, beautiful opening sequence where he's walking around in society and everybody's acting like a zombie, and then the zombie apocalypse happens and he doesn't really notice. That, I think, is so clever, and I think it shows the sort of stealth nature of the zombie invasion, that, you know, the zombies will probably be here and we won't really actually notice that much. And, you know, if you see someone wandering and shambling around, you know, with kind of looking a bit unkempt and, you know, like dead eyes, you don't think zombie, you think, oh, they had a bit too much to drink, or, you know, they had a big night last night, and, you know, then the zombies come and get us, right? And so I think it's that Shaun of the Dead model, at least, that says, yes, this could take over us. I think what perhaps has not been explored, though, which might be a bit terrifying, is what if the zombies invade via the zombie walk? And so the zombies march down the street, and we all think, oh, it's that zombie walk again, right? There they are, right in the middle of us, and they're poised, ready to strike.
You are making me never go to a zombie walk again. Honestly. I'll just bring the sword. So the last part of her question was, what ingredient is the most common mistake that they make?
I think the biggest mistake is holding yourself up in a farmhouse or a pub or a, you know, shopping mall or something. This is the worst plan in the universe, because what do? You lock yourself away with a bunch of idiots who will all argue amongst themselves. How long have you got to survive? You've got until the stupidest member of your party decides to open the door, as they always do, and let the zombies in. So, you know, what exactly are you thinking in this sort of long-term plan? I think if you are going to go to an individualist model, then you have to go really individualistic and hide off on just your own. Otherwise, you have to really trust your team. And it's not like you built your team out of your hand-picked friends. It's you built your team out of whoever you happen to run into on the street who was still alive. So I think the big mistake is that they don't work together very well. And I think this comes back to the idea of civilization. Even a mini-civilization, you have to be very, very functional in your interdependent society. Even if there's only six of you in a basement somewhere, you really need to operate as a team and understand this.
So really, stealing a school bus and attaching armor to it is a good idea.
I think this would be a great idea, yes. As long as no zombies are already on the bus, I think we'll be fine.
And last question, Robert Smith. Now, why is there a question mark in your surname?
Well, my name is very, very common, and so I added the question mark about 20 years ago to distinguish myself from all the other Robert Smiths out there, including the guy from The Cure, who I kept imagining his career would die up any day now, and that was over 20 years ago, and it's still not gone, so I decided to just give in and, you know, make myself my own identity instead of stealing his.
I like you, sir. I'm glad you're on our side.
Thank you.
And thanks very much for being here.
Yes, you're very welcome.
You can read Robert's zombie-related research at the link on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. And we'll be right back with more on zombies after this.
Skeptically Speaking is rebroadcast on a number of fine radio stations. To find out where Skeptically Speaking airs near you, to listen to past episodes, or download the weekly podcast, check out our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. While you're there, follow the links to connect with us on our Facebook page, our Twitter feed, or to subscribe to the show in iTunes. And now, back to the show.
I'm talking today with David Hughes, who is, as of this month, an assistant professor of entomology and biology at Penn State. He holds a doctorate in entomology from the University of Oxford and a bachelor's degree in zoology from the University of Glasgow. His research interests include the genomics and transcriptomics of behavioral manipulation by parasitic organisms and the way evolutionary theory can be integrated into disease and pest management. Welcome to Skeptically Speaking, David.
Thank you very much for having me on.
Now, you recently discovered a fungus that turns ants into zombies. So how did you stumble onto that?
Indeed, it had been known for quite a while, but a few years ago, we started a concerted effort to follow up those early natural history observations which people had made. It's a system which is rather unique in the lexicon of host-parasite interactions. It's where a fungus gets into an ant and changes the behavior, causing them to leave the nest and to die in rather unusual places, usually in tropical forests attached to the underside of a leaf. And so while we've known about it for many, many years, we hadn't really studied it in any great detail, and that's what I've been doing over the last few years.
So how does it do that exactly? What's the process?
Well, the process is like many, many fungi which infect insects. And the biggest thing which kills insects out in the forest are indeed fungi. And they attach very precisely to the cuticle of an ant or whatever is walking around the forest floor. And then using enzymes, the fungus grows through the skin and into the body, and there it starts proliferating. And in most cases, this just ends up with the death of the insect. It dies on the forest floor, and then the fungus grows out of its body, produces spores, and affects new insects. But in the case of one small group, which I study, it does something else which is remarkable. It in some way instructs the individual insect, in this case an ant, to go to a very special place in the forest. And this special place we discovered is the underside of leaves, where the ants attached very rigidly to the major veins, leaves in a particular orientation in space, a particular height off the ground, about 25 centimeters off the ground. And all of this happens at a particular time of day, solar noon. So it's a remarkably specific manipulation of ant behavior by something which is, after all, just a rather simple fungus.
So is this neurological then?
Undoubtedly, it is. We know from some of the work which is just coming out that the fungus in some way controls the muscles of the ant. And one way that muscles can be controlled is by affecting the nerve endings which innervate them. So if you think of something like carpal tunnel syndrome from too much typing, your nerves get all cramped. And that's sort of what we think is happening. And this broad group of fungi are known to produce very interesting compounds, alkaloids. The recreational drug LSD comes from this broad group of fungi, or rather the derivative of it came from this group of fungi back in the 1930s. So they produce something really interesting which has an ability to affect nerve processes.
Now you figured out that a fungus that was originally thought to be a single species was in fact four separate species.
Yes, indeed. So the fungus has a rather dramatic shape. So when these ants attach to this underside of the leaf, they die, and then a fungus grows a large stalk out of the back of the ant's head, produces a round little body on that stalk, which produces spores which are shot out to infect new ants. And for 150 years, people have collected these rather rarely and brought them back into the herbaria, dry them as scientists tend to do for fungi, but nobody had really examined them in detail in the forest. And when we started to do that, we found a range of different species having very different strategies of infecting, of ways to catch ants. And we feel this is really just a tip of an iceberg. We were working, this study was in southern Brazil, but we're also working in central Brazil on the equator, in Colombia, in Ghana, and Thailand and Australia. And as we're working in all those places, we're finding a huge diversity among the range of ways fungi can get into ants. The question then following on from that is there also a way, different ways they can control the behavior?
That was actually my second question. So my first question was, do they target different species of ants then?
There are about 20,000 species of ants which we think exist. 14,000 species have names on them. And it's remarkable that of all the diverse ants we have, these fungi tend to focus on a very small group, which are the carpenter ants, those which are very common in North America and common across the world indeed. And these are just the general ants you might see running around in a park in your neighborhood. And so for whatever reason, these fungi tend to like those ants and tend to control their behavior.
But you don't know at this point if they do cause different behaviors.
No, we don't know that at the moment. And so what we're trying to do by taking this worldwide view is by collecting as many samples as possible to see if there are indeed patterns which we can then discover.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking. I'm talking to David Hughes, Assistant Professor of Entomology and Biology at Penn State. He's also one of the gentlemen who discovered a fungus that turns ants into zombie ants. Now, these fungi aren't the only species to do this. You were part of a team that produced a paper called Invasion of the Body Snatchers, the Diversity and Evolution of Manipulative Strategies in Host-Parasite Interactions. That sounds both interesting and disturbing.
Yes, it is. It was a sort of a collective action by a number of researchers who work on this group of parasites which do change behavior. And we were trying to corral the data we had and try to understand where we were in our research and predict ways we could go in the future. So there are a lot of different systems out there where we see parasites changing behavior. Another well-known example are these Gordian worms, which are large worms living inside crickets, causing them to go to pools in the forest at particular times in the night. And the crickets, when they're infected, they jump into water. And the reason for this is the worm needs to live in the water. So it causes this sort of suicide behavior, as is described. And then an enormous worm crawls out of the back of the cricket and goes on to mate and produce eggs, which then infect new crickets. So there's a range of different systems out there. And this paper was trying to review those, synthesize those, and think about ways we could go in the future to understand them.
Well, you mentioned that the basis for this research really starts with the conceptual framework created by Richard Dawkins.
Yeah, so Richard did a really fabulous thing back in the early 80s. Following on from his enormously successful Selfish Gene in 1976, he produced a book called The Extended Phenotype. And very simply, what he did was that the phenotypes that biologists are so interested in and have always been interested in, like flower color, antler length, hair color, activity, aggression, all of these phenotypes, they stop on the surface of the body. And what Richard said, well, why should that be the case? Why don't we consider a beaver dam as a phenotype of beaver genes, or a bird's nest as a phenotype of bird genes? And indeed, if a beaver fails to build a good dam, it's going to affect its fitness. And so that's something which is under selection. So that's the extended phenotype. Another example of the extended phenotype that Dawkins proposed was parasites changing behavior. So in the case of these ants, which are manipulated by fungi, what we're looking at there is not ant behavior, it's fungus behavior. The fungus, through evolutionary time, has evolved chemicals which effectively control ant muscles and really ant legs, allowing the fungus to be transported through the environment to exactly the position, the microclimate it needs to go to, and therefore grow better. And so this is the extended phenotype. The changed behavior is a property of the parasite and not of the host.
Well, this sounds like a really complicated survival strategy. If I was going to argue that something was irreducibly complex, which I'm not, but if I was, this sounds like the perfect candidate. Do we know what the intermediate steps were in the evolutionary path that led to zombie ants?
You think we should, and you're absolutely right, but we don't. We're guessing here. A lot of effort has gone into understanding complex phenotypes like the vertebrate eye and understanding the intermediate stages, but we really don't know how it started. We know that fungi have been infecting insects for over 200 million years. I and colleagues in the Smithsonian and also in Bonn in Germany discovered a fossil leaf from 48 million years ago in Germany, which was a tropical forest at the time. And this leaf bore those telltale signs of ants biting onto the leaf surface, which is only caused by these fungi. And so we know that the fungi are causing this behavior for about 50 million years. But intermediate steps is something perplexing to think about, and it's difficult to think about also.
You're tuned in to Skeptically Speaking. My guest is entomologist David Hughes, and we're talking about manipulative strategies in host-parasite interactions, otherwise known as zombifying. And that's probably not a technical term. And we'll be right back with more after this.
On the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, we talk to professional magicians about how the study and practice of magic can help teach critical thinking skills. We'll talk to sleight of hand master Jamie Ian Swiss and Scam School creator Brian Brushwood about the ways that magic can demonstrate and help us overcome our cognitive limitations. And we're joined by Michael Godot to talk about his career as a performer and his work on Penn & Teller's television projects. That's next week on Skeptically Speaking on your local radio station or online at skepticallyspeaking.com.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell. My guest for this segment of today's All Zombie episode is David Hughes, Assistant Professor of Entomology and Biology at Penn State. We have an audience question from Mandy Dax. Is there anything behind the idea that toxoplasma actually makes people love cats more or contributes to crazy cat lady syndrome?
That's a fabulous question, Mandy. I don't know if they should love cats more. There's a theory by a really eminent evolution biologist called Kevin Lafferty that maybe actually toxoplasma would make us fear cats, not those you keep in your house, but those massive predators of times gone by on the African savannas, or the saber-toothed cats, which humans did interact with way back when, such that, you know, we were a host of toxoplasma, and that increased the chances that we would be predated upon by these massive carnivores. So the association with loving them, we don't have any evidence for that. We have no evidence that indeed it's involved with transmission either way.
Now, toxoplasma is actually quite interesting. Maybe could you explain that a bit?
Toxoplasma is this small parasite which naturally occurs inside rats, and it causes a rather distinct change in behavior, something called trophic transmission. So when the parasite is ready to go to the next host, it has two hosts in his life cycle, it causes its first host, the rat, to lose complete fear of cats and approach them. So in well set up experimental studies, rats would choose to go towards a cat in preference to some other source of such as the smell of a rabbit or the presence of a rabbit. And what happens when a rat goes towards a cat? Well, the cat eats it and the parasite gets just what it wants, because the parasite develops in the brain of the cat as a final host. So it manipulates the behavior of the intermediate host to go into the final host. Humans also get toxoplasma, and there's quite compelling evidence that the presence of this parasite in our bodies, in our brains, can change our behavior, and it correlates with a range of different traits, such as neuroticism, such as gender roles, you know, increased machismo. And we know that countries vary in their prevalence of toxoplasma, and through correlative studies, which don't prove but just suggest a relationship, we see that the presence of this brain parasite, toxoplasma, correlates with many traits at a national level.
Now, this is interesting, because after I received this question, I had to do a little bit of research on this. So the number that keeps getting thrown around is that something like 90% of France is infected with toxoplasmosis.
Poor France. It seems always to be signaled out for this reason. And I wonder if that's just because there's something about the phenotype of French people that allows us to jump to this level. But indeed, it does come out many, many times to be very high levels. And we associate that because of the propensity to eat a lot of undercooked meat. Brazil is another country where there's extremely high levels of toxoplasma prevalence. And one of my colleagues, Kevin Lafferty, did a wonderful study where he correlated the levels across national borders with various traits. And, you know, he found some really remarkable patterns.
So how do you diagnose that infection? And is that something you can be aware of?
You must diagnose it. If you are pregnant, it's one of the first tests your doctor will do to see if you indeed carried the antigens for toxoplasma if you've been exposed in the past, because if you pick it up during pregnancy, it's extremely dangerous for your developing fetus. And so women who perhaps do keep cats and haven't picked up the infection before become pregnant are advised not to associate with cats too much, and certainly not change the litter boxes of cats, because this is a route for infection.
So besides that, is this something that would really be considered hazardous if you aren't pregnant? Because minor mood alterations, is that bad?
I don't think it is. And I think within any sort of population, we're going to have wide variations in moods for a whole range of reasons. So no, not at all bad.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking. I'm here with David Hughes, Assistant Professor of Entomology and Biology at Penn State. And we're talking about behavioral manipulation by parasitic organisms. So, do you know by any chance what the first mind-controlling parasite species was that was discovered?
There were some studies on acanthocephalins, which are these spiny headed worms, which goes back to the 50s and 60s and even earlier. These are one group of parasitic organisms, which are all, as far as we discovered so far, exclusively parasitic. And they change a range of invertebrate behavior insects, quite often causing them to be predated upon more, with this trophic transmission I discussed in the toxoplasma section. Mm-hmm. And so this is one of the earlier examples. It's really interesting with the study of parasite manipulation of behavior. It's something that has been ignored by the larger community of evolutionary biologists for a very, very long time. And it's only in the last 5-10 years has there been increased levels of studies on them, and even the wider community becoming more interested in them. Which strikes me because the public is extremely interested in this.
Very.
And this is an interesting point which goes to the history of evolutionary biology, which, you know, biology is always playing a second fiddle to physics and chemistry. And in some way, the study of parasites and manipulate behavior is some way seen as, you know, just not good enough science. And this is one reason why it's not accepted by the broader community or not studied in great detail. The other reason, of course, is that historically, biologists have not really considered parasites as a group. And now, in the last 10 years, we've discovered through a lot of really excellent studies that half of life that's evolved on the planet is a parasite.
What makes you think to look for a parasite in the first place in these kind of situations? Like, is there a sort of general type of behavior change that would make you suspicious?
With the case of these zombie fungi, the behavior is really rather dramatic. You get these dead ants attached to leaves in tropical forests. And we've known about this for 150 years. The very first biologist to record an example of this was Alfred Russel Wallace, who was the co-discoverer of natural selection along with Darwin. So it's not as if it's unknown. I think in the case of other parasite systems, you can just characterize a whole group of animals within one species of population as having one type of behavior, and then you look for aberrations. That's what the parasites cause. They cause aberrations because at some stage, parasites want to do something different than the uninfected hosts. And usually that different thing that they want to do is related to transmission.
Most of the behaviors that these parasites seem to inspire are obviously beneficial for them, but not exactly helpful for the hosts. So are there any species that manage to help the hosts instead of inspiring suicide?
No.
Okay. And
there are organisms, symbionts, that do help the host. They don't, not by changing the behavior, but by producing defensive compounds. A fungus which lives in grass produces some interesting alkaloids that stops horses and cows eating the grass. But these are mutualists that we talk about. The actual freaky changes in behavior, that's really something that only the parasites have come up with.
Well, I believe I read that there are sometimes these kind of host-manipulating organisms that they're used as a biological pesticide. Is that correct?
There are many parasites, particularly the fungal parasites, which are used as a biopesticide. So the group that I work on, these are called sexual fungi, teleomorphs, and there's an asexual stage, which is called an anamorph. And this is a particularly interesting organism because it's a fungus. It's not as specific as the one I work on, and it can invade a wide range of different insects. And because of that, people interested in controlling pest insects are using it. So it's not, they're not using it because of its ability to change behavior. They're using it because of its ability to kill insects.
Right. Are there any non-microscopic parasites that can control the brains of their hosts? And I possibly watch too much science fiction.
There are. There are large insects which live inside the body of other insects and control behavior. Sometimes they live on the outside of the body and just hang on there. There are barnacles living inside crabs, which once they get inside the crab and then ramify throughout its body, they have these processes which intertwine around the crab's nervous system. So the volume is now 70% parasite. So yes, these parasites can be enormous. Quite often they become very large by preventing the host reproducing in something called parasitic castration. So all of the resources go into the parasite itself. And this is very interesting because it now teaches us not to think of parasites as these minute microscopic things, which maybe there's lots of them, but they're not so important. When you start thinking that 50, 60, 70% of a crab is really a parasite, then you start to think the biomass is enormous.
Well, on that note, we have a question from Honor. What's the weirdest behavior you've ever seen one of these parasites cause?
I think the weirdest is this barnacle I just alluded to, which is called Cyclinia. There are some reports that when this barnacle is floating through the sea and it lands on a crab, it takes over the female crab's reproductive organs, causes the female crab to look after the parasite's eggs rather than the female's eggs, and that's all fine. And what crabs do is they waft oxygenated water over the parasite eggs, and parasite grows up and becomes happy. The problem is the sea is wide, and when this little barnacle lands on a male crab, what should it do? What it does is it apparently changes the behavior of the male to induce his maternal behavior in the male, but also allows the male to grow female appendages, essentially transforming its sex. And I think that's kind of funky.
Yeah, that's the understatement of the day, sir. I will give the last question to Adam A. Are there any species that you suspect are being targeted by brain parasites that haven't been discovered yet?
That's an interesting question. So one of the things I am working on is looking at the reverse of manipulation, which is defensive behavior. So one thing in human groups, we potentially see, trying to explain why humans look after the infectious sick. You know, there's an explanation why you would look after your family members, you're related to them. But why would you look after strangers? And in the long history of human epidemics and pandemics, there have been these examples of extreme altruism, and explaining that is incredibly difficult. So what I'm starting to do now is to work with religious scholars who can quantify the different religious groups over time. And I'm asking, to what extent does belief affect your propensity to care for the infectious sick? So as we built cities over millennia, we have created conditions for epidemics to thrive and prosper. This has led to situations where 1/3 to 1/2 of the city inhabitants die. And in those cases, we see some individuals come forward and express extreme altruism and care for the infectious sick, and quite often losing their lives. My speculation is that it's religious belief which underscores this change in behavior or variation in belief. It's not the simplistic, yes, I do or I do not believe. It's how the different orders mandate caring towards strangers that are important.
Now, how is this linked to parasites?
It's anti-parasite behavior. So it's just a flip. So when we look at parasites manipulating the behavior of ants, for example, we also have to think about how do ants themselves respond in a way that reduces the incidence of infection. And ants are incredibly good at this by cleaning environment and preventing the entry of individuals who are not part of the colony, and so on and so forth. In human societies, it's more difficult. And one way we have to deal with infectious diseases is through behavioral defenses. And I'm interested in what was the situation in, for example, Europe during the Black Death, when you had massive die-offs. Was human behavior important in mediating who looks after the sick, yes or no?
When will that research be done?
I'm starting that now at Penn State with a world expert on religious studies, the history of Christianity, and he's fabulously well-known and interesting, and also a researcher who's a young researcher like myself. She works in Malawi on populations of individuals in Malawi and HIV infections and how the different religious groups there deal with the stigma of infection, which is quite an important societal issue in that place.
You are going to be getting another call from me, sir.
Yes, I think it'd be interesting. Yeah.
Thanks very much for being here, David.
It was a pleasure, Desiree. I really enjoyed it. Thank you very much indeed.
You can find links to the work of David Hughes on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. Since you're there, you might like to click the links to Facebook, to Twitter, and to iTunes, where you can subscribe to the show, listen to past episodes, or leave a review. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on Skeptically Speaking. I'm here with Michael Goudeau, professional juggler and entertainer, and writer-producer on Penn and Teller's television projects. So you'll be on the show next week to talk more about your work with Penn and Teller, but you're here today to tell us about a particular event that's happening on April 17th?
That is correct. Penn and Teller celebrate 10 years with the Aid for AIDS Nevada Walk. We do this every year, and it will be Sunday, April 17th in Las Vegas. Walk starts at 10:30 a.m., and this is just a walk to raise money for housing and to help care for people living with HIV here in Nevada. With a $75 donation, you get 2 complimentary tickets to see the Penn & Teller show live at the Rio, and I would like to point out that those tickets are more than $75 each for one. So this is a good deal. $75, you'll get that. You get a 2-for-1 buffet voucher for Caesars Entertainment Properties, a Penn & Teller Challenge Walk t-shirt, and access to the VIP tent.
So this is actually Penn & Teller's 10th year as marshals?
10th consecutive year they will serve as grand marshals for this walk. And it's pretty exciting. You know what? Penn & Teller also match all the donations that come in through their team. So if you join the Penn & Teller team and you make a donation, Penn & Teller match all monetary funds donated through their team. So this is your chance to break them.
So where can people go for more information?
Not surprisingly, on the web at www.afanlv.org. And there are banners on the page. They'll click your right to the AIDS walk.
Wonderful. Good luck, sir.
Thank you. It's going to be a great day.
And we'll see you next week.
Bring it on. The skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell. Break the spell of Pavlov's bells. Cause we're skeptically speaking on mind reading tarot cards and witches, psychics, and their spoon bending mind tricks. All the humbug, flim flam, frauds and shams, the charlatan who I don't think you understand. It's the hocus pocus, out of focus, locus, eroding the brain, making gains on the hopeless. Let the crystal ball fall, smash on the floor. Leave the pieces alone, we don't need them anymore. Just a microscope, telescope, magnifier, reading in between the lines of these lies. Bring it on. The skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, cause we're skeptically speaking.
Skeptically Speaking is produced with the support of CJSR 88.5 FM in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. Our studio assistants are Brent Kelly and Lisa Skovanek. Ryan Bromsgrove is our studio technician and research assistant. The show is produced and edited by K.O. Myers. Our theme song was written and recorded by A.O.K. And I'm your host, Desiree Shell.